Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to this week's Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Well, it being the late May bank holiday, I'm not around this week as is regularly the case this time of year because this year I'm away pretending to be Master Constable Dogberry in our annual Community Players production, which this year is Much Ado About Nothing. As usual, apparently, by Shakespeare. As most of you know, I really enjoy this time of year, but it does mean that I end up tied up in rehearsals and all sorts of things, which means that I can't actually be here live. This year, Synchro is also involved, and she's in the band, so we're next door at the moment. As I say, pretending to be somebody else. I was thinking of playing some podcasts and thing, or assembling a show of podcasts for you to listen to whilst I'm away, but instead I decided in the long run to have a look at a document called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. It's something I've seen referred to several times in my researches over recent years, and a few weeks back I finally got around to downloading a copy of it and having a quick read, and it struck me as being, it's very chilling. But it's also quite entertaining. It's a pretty lean piece of writing. There's not a lot of unnecessary stuff in it. And it very much reads like a science fiction dystopia. It's kind of frank and detailed and really, in its own way, very entertaining. It's, I guess, a kind of breakdown, apparently, of just exactly what the global economy actually is, how the machine works, what it's for, and who it is that's devising it for use. It contains some solutions within it, because the very nature of the document itself means that it's important that the information contained therein remains secret, or at least not available to the public. As such, some of the solutions in it are explicit. Others are implicit because, in as far as it's a detailed description of methods being used to implement, it would appear, absolute economic control, something that could only be managed with a little difficulty and a bit of concentration when the document was first researched and written. But things have changed quite a lot with the advent of technology, such that a lot of the difficulties that were involved in those early years have been very successfully worked around, which is another thing that interests me about the document, is how we can see that changes in society, changes in communication, changes in technology have made it a lot easier to implement the kind of things that are being described herein. And it's also become possible to become ever more detailed in the methods of control that are being used, because what's really needed for this sort of system is detailed input. And one thing that the world management team are certainly managing to get now is a lot of very detailed input. It also allows us, I think, to review in kind of one session lots of the subjects that are regularly covered on People's Internet Radio. The document's about 40 pages or so long in all. 10 or 12 of those pages are technical diagrams, which of course I'm not going to be able to put across, and I'm not particularly interested in them for the purposes of this exercise either. They show circuit diagrams which relate economics to electrical energy systems, and there's a few pages of equations as well which show how the analysis of data can be used to predict outcomes as a result of the inputs. Like I say, they're not really my concern here. I'll give you references so you can go and get the whole document if you want, and perhaps people who understand these things a little better than I might want to go and have a look at those. I've broken it down into bite-sized chunks. Synchro has very kindly agreed to read out the bits of it that I'm interested in, and again, we probably won't be covering the whole document, simply the chunks that are most chilling and of greatest interest to me, and hopefully to you as well. It's pretty intense information, so probably sort of 10-minute chunks, something like that, and small sections of elucidation, perhaps discussion if I can pin synchro down, and also some carefully selected tunes to allow the mind to relax in between the various bits and bobs that we're going to be looking at. I got the document from a website called stopthecrime.net, which is still up there on the web and is well worth a look in my opinion. It's got a lot of quite interesting information on it. And as far as I can see, stopthecrime.net got the document from another website called lawfulpath.com, which is also an interesting website. It deals with a lot of matters that we deal with. It's an American site, so it tends to be centered on American ideas, but as we know, the things that are happening in America and the things that are relevant in America are generally relevant here and, as they say, throughout the world. So I'm going to just whip through two or three pages of introduction that Lawful Path put at the beginning of it all, and then we can move on to Synchro's first bit of reading of the document Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. Lawfulpath.com start off by saying, the following document is taken from two sources. The first was acquired on a website, of which I can't remember the address, they say, listing as its source the book titled Behold a Pale Horse by William Cooper, a favourite of Dr. Rock. The second source is a crudely copied booklet which does not contain a copyright notice or a publisher's name. With the exception of the foreword, the preface, the main thing that was missing from the first source was the illustrations. As we began comparing the two documents, we realised that the illustrations and the accompanying text, which was also missing from the first document, made up a significant part of the document. This has now been restored by the Lawful Path, and so far as I know, is the only internet copy available complete with illustrations. It seems to me, actually, that the reason why the two things were separated was because it's very easy to print out text. It's a lot more difficult to, or takes a lot more work to print out things like circuit diagrams and equations that have mathematical functions and things that aren't necessarily available on your standard computer keyboard. And indeed, the illustrations that are in the copy of the document I've got are really quite charming. They really remind me of old courier-type typewriters and those old blue or pink gestetner sheets we used to get when we were at school. The introduction goes on to say, we have no first-hand knowledge that this document is genuine. However, many of the concepts contained herein are certainly reasonable, important, and bear strong consideration. And I would add there that they are also clearly relevant to the situation we find ourselves in. Hopefully, as you hear these things described, you're going to realise pretty quickly that what we're looking at is something that, even if it was entirely made up, which seems pretty unlikely to me, it does provide a pretty tidy description of the world in which we find ourselves. The foreword says, this manuscript was delivered to our offices by an unknown person. We did not steal the document, nor are we involved with any theft from the United States government, and we did not get the document by way of any dishonest methods. We feel that we are not endangering the national security by reproducing this document, quite the contrary. It has been authenticated, and we feel that we are not only within our rights to publish it, but morally bound to do so. Regarding the training manual, you may have detected that we had to block out the marginal notes made by the selectee at the CIA training centre, but I can assure you that the manual is authentic and was printed for the purpose of introducing the selectee to the conspiracy. It has been authenticated by four different technical writers of military intelligence, one just recently retired who wants very much to have this manual distributed throughout the world, one who is still employed as an electronics engineer by the federal government and has access to the entire series of training manuals, I bet they'd make interesting reading. One was stationed in Hawaii and held the highest security clearance in naval intelligence, and another who is now teaching at a university and has been working with the Central Intelligence Agency for many years and wants out before the axe falls on the conspirators. Now, of course, we don't have the names of any of those people, so we can't assure ourselves that it has been authenticated as described. But as I say, I'm pretty sure that the contents speak for themselves. They continue, "We believe that the entire world should know about this plan, so we distributed internationally 100 of these manuscripts to ask individuals at top-level positions their opinions. The consensus opinion was to distribute this to as many people as who wanted it, to the end that they would not only understand that war had been declared against them, but would be able properly to identify the true enemy to humanity. Conspiracy theories are nothing new to history. Plots to kill Caesar and overthrow Rome abounded, for instance. However, it is seldom that concrete clues to such plots come to light and are generally known. Silent weapons for quiet wars, an introduction programming manual, was uncovered quite by accident on July the 7th, 1986, when an employee of Boeing Aircraft Company purchased a surplus IBM copier for scrap parts at a sale and discovered inside details of a plan hatched in the embryonic days of the Cold War, which called for control of the masses through manipulation of industry, people's pastimes, education, and political leanings. It called for a quiet revolution, pitting brother against brother, and diverting the public's attention from what is really going on. The document you are about to hear is real. It is reprinted in its virgin form with diagrams.
Top Secret. Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. Operations Research Technical Manual. TW-SW7905.1. Welcome aboard. This publication marks the 25th anniversary of the Third World War, called the Quiet War, being conducted using subjective biological warfare, fought with silent weapons. This book contains an introductory description of this war, its strategies, and its weaponry. May 1979 #74-1120. It is patently impossible to discuss social engineering or the automation of a society, that is, the engineering of social automation systems or silent weapons, on a national or worldwide scale without implying extensive objectives of social control and destruction of human life through slavery and genocide. This manual is in itself an analogue declaration of intent. Such a writing must be secured from public scrutiny, otherwise it might be recognised as a technically formal declaration of domestic war. Furthermore, whenever any person or group of persons in a position of great power and without full knowledge and consent of the public uses such knowledge and methodologies for economic conquest, it must be understood that a state of domestic warfare exists between said person or group of persons and the public. The solution of today's problems requires an approach which is ruthlessly candid, with no agonizing over religious, moral, or cultural values. You have qualified for this project because of your ability to look at human society with cold objectivity, and yet analyze and discuss your observations and conclusions with others of similar intellectual capacity, without the loss of discretion or humility. Such virtues are exercised in your own best interest. Do not deviate from them. Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research, a strategic and tactical methodology developed under the military management in England during World War II. The original purpose of operations research was to study the strategic and tactical problems of air and land defence with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies. It was soon recognised by those in positions of power that the same methods might be used for totally controlling a society. But better tools were necessary. Social engineering, or the analysis and automation of a society, requires the correlation of great amounts of constantly changing economic information. So a high-speed, computerized data processing system was necessary, which could race ahead of the society and predict when society would arrive for capitulation. Relay computers were too slow, but the electronic computer invented in 1946 filled the bill. The next breakthrough was the development of the simplex method of linear programming in 1947. Then in 1948, the transistor promised great expansion of the computer field by reducing space and power requirements. With these three inventions under their direction, those in positions of power strongly suspected that it was possible for them to control the whole world with the push of a button. Immediately, the Rockefeller Foundation got in on the ground floor by making a 4-year grant to Harvard College, funding the Harvard Economic Research Project for the study of the structure of the American economy. 1 year later, in 1949, the United States Air Force joined in. In 1952, the grant period terminated, and a high-level meeting of the elite was held to determine the next phase of social operations research. The Harvard Project had been very fruitful, as is borne out by the publication of some of its results in 1953, suggesting the feasibility of economic engineering. Engineered in the last half of the decade of the 1940s, the new quiet war machine stood, so to speak, in sparkling, gold-plated hardware on the showroom floor by 1954. With the creation of the Mazer in 1954, the promise of unlocking unlimited resources of fusion atomic energy from the heavy hydrogen in seawater and the consequent availability of unlimited social power was a possibility only decades away. The combination was irresistible. Although the silent weapon system was nearly exposed 13 years later, the evolution of the new weapon system has never suffered any major setbacks. This volume marks the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the Quiet War. Already, this domestic war has had many victories on many fronts throughout the world. In 1954, it was well recognized by those in positions of authority that it was only a matter of time, only a few decades, before the general public would be able to grasp and upset the cradle of power. For the very elements of the new silent weapon technology were as accessible for a public utopia as they were for providing a private utopia. The issue of primary concern, that of dominance, revolved around the subject of the energy sciences. Energy is recognized as the key to all activity on Earth. Natural science is the study of the sources and control of natural energy, and social science, theoretically expressed as economics, is the study of the sources and control of social energy. Both are bookkeeping systems, mathematics. Therefore, mathematics is the primary energy science, and the bookkeeper can be king if the public can be kept ignorant of the methodology of the bookkeeping. All science is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge. The end is control. Beyond this remains only one issue. Who will be the beneficiary? In 1954, this was the issue of primary concern. Although the so-called moral issues were raised, in view of the law of natural selection, it was agreed that a nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such People Are Beasts of Burden and Stakes on the Table by Choice and Consent. Consequently, in the interest of future world order, peace and tranquility, it was decided to privately wage a quiet war against the American public, with an ultimate objective of permanently shifting the natural and social energy of the undisciplined and irresponsible many into the hands of the self-disciplined, responsible and worthy few. In order to implement this objective, it was necessary to create, secure, and apply new weapons, which, as it turned out, were a class of weapons so subtle and sophisticated in their principle of operation and public appearance as to earn for themselves the name silent weapons. In conclusion, the objective of economic research as conducted by the magnates of banking and the industries of goods and services is the establishment of an economy which is totally predictable and manipulable. In order to achieve a totally predictable economy, the low-class elements of society must be brought under total control. That is, they must be housebroken, trained, and assigned a yoke and long-term social duties from a very early age, before they have an opportunity to question the propriety of the matter. In order to achieve such conformity, the lower-class family unit must be disintegrated by a process of increasing preoccupation of the parents and the establishment of government-operated daycare centres for the occupationally orphaned children. The quality of education given to the lower class must be of the poorest sort, so that the moat of ignorance isolating the inferior class from the superior class is and remains incomprehensible to the inferior class. With such an initial handicap, even bright lower-class individuals have little, if any, hope of extricating themselves from their assigned lot in life. This form of slavery is essential to maintain some measure of social order, peace, and tranquility for the ruling upper class.
So now you know. The solution of today's problems requires an approach which is ruthlessly candid, with no agonizing over religious, moral, or cultural values. There are precious few moral values contained within this document, which I suppose shouldn't really surprise us very much, given that we know that we're dealing with and talking about people who have no empathy for the folk of the this beautiful blue ball on which we all live. It strikes me as well that there's some clues in the language that's being used. It seems to me that the selectee or inductee, whatever we want to call him, at the CIA who's reading this introduction manual is quite likely a patsy who's being programmed through the use of language. The CIA agent is in all likelihood not a member of the elite, and as such, he's really as much a target as the rest of the population, who are referred to throughout the document as the lower classes. It seems to me that the lower classes here are everybody who is not actually a member of the elite. And he's told, you have qualified for this project because of your ability to look at human society with cold objectivity, and yet discuss your observations and conclusions with others of similar intellectual capacity without the loss of discretion or humility. Very interesting words there. Similar intellectual capacity, I don't think it really has anything to do with intellectual capacity, does it? It's got much more to do with moral capacity, or perhaps more accurately, a more or less complete lack thereof. And discretion or humility, loss of discretion obviously involves not telling the rest of the herd, and spooking the cattle will definitely not be smiled upon. And the word humility, that is an especially interesting word, I think, because it's not the agent's humility that's being appealed to here. It's, as is often the case with compartmentalization, it's a matter of I guess, getting somebody involved in something and then making them feel that it's a kind of privilege to be involved there. It's telling people, telling him what to think, really, disguised in the words. We see a lot of this going on, do we not? I find it, I guess, not entirely surprising to hear that the kind of strenuousness that is needed when war is being waged, you've got very limited time, very limited resources to try and pull off whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. I guess what's occurring there is the use of minimum resources or whatever resources are available and committing them to obtaining maximum gain under the circumstances. And after the experience of the First and the Second World War, it was soon recognised by those in positions of power, and we'll hear how they get their power a bit later in the document, that these same methods might be used for totally controlling a society. And I would imagine that that is how it's come about, that whilst there was fighting in Europe for decades, centuries, the British, so-called, were fighting the French or the Spanish or the Portuguese or whoever it might have been. And the spooky silence since then is probably, I would guess, because there is some truth in what's being said here, that the logistics, that the intelligence, that all of the things that were necessary for fighting a war could be used in peacetime to gain similar sorts of control, but this time over a peacetime population. I guess we shouldn't be surprised to hear that the Rockefeller Foundation spotted the potential of all of this and got in on the ground floor by making this 4-year grant to the Harvard College, funding a thing called the Harvard Economic Research Project, of which, again, a little bit more later. I was a bit, and it's perhaps a bit of an eye opener that the Rockefeller's partners fairly rapidly became the United States Air Force. Whoopee, eh? The word positions of power and positions of authority turn up a lot in this document, and we will hear that those have been kind of assumed, again, through consent, through the people handing over their power to others. We heard that the very elements of the new silent weapon technology were as accessible for a public utopia as they were for providing a private utopia. Of course, if it is genuinely possible to control an economy and to assure its inputs and its outputs, then the only question, as they say here, is who exactly is going to be the beneficiary. I thought it was interesting to hear that economics is the study of the sources and control of social energy, not, we notice, the study of the economy. In fact, as has become clear to us, has it not, how the economy actually works is the last thing the elites want us to understand. If we did, the population would, I suspect, be very much less pliant. And economics as a mathematical study is the primary energy science, as they say here. And whoever it is that controls the mathematics and the knowledge of the economy is the bookkeeper. He can be king, so long as the public can be kept ignorant of the methodology of the bookkeeping and just exactly what it is that the books are describing. Of course, it is entirely a bookkeeping exercise, something we have suspected for some time. Science, they say, is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge, the end is control, and the only question is who will be the beneficiary. It seems to me that much of the science that's going on nowadays, although it is in pursuance of knowledge, it's in pursuance of silent knowledge, really private knowledge. Science, it seems clear, that benefits the mass of humanity is seldom funded, seldom replicated, or published. Results that, on the other hand, cause damage, disadvantage and distress, results which generate income for the corporations and the industrial complex, are the results that get pursued. Armaments, vaccines, genetically modified organisms, weather control, surveillance technology, inefficient and more poisonous transport systems, burning and sinking oil rigs, poison seas, sick and impoverished populations are the general outcome. Science that works the other way, or call science, investigations that say yield results that are to the direct, simple and cheap and effective use of populations are seldom made public and quite often legislated against, it seems to me. We're encouraged to concentrate on wants rather than needs in this economy. What we basically need is shelter, food, warmth, and as a social animal, I guess, the company of others. These can be relatively easily fulfilled. Not too much work involved in that, but by generating a world in which there are many, many things to buy, and by encouraging people to want, we're effectively encouraging a world in which people spend all of their time working, paying taxes, and pursuing things that pretty shortly they're going to have to throw away and buy a new one, either the upgraded one or because the old one has just kind of died. And I guess it also does encourage a kind of greed, a kind of concentration, because it's so intense on what we want next. And the distraction from needs means that we're distracted not only from our own needs, but from the needs of others around us. It was agreed that a nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. It's only kind of sort of a matter of choice, isn't it? Because if you don't really know what's going on, and if you're being kept, or you're keeping yourself under such pressure to achieve all of the things that you've got to achieve before the end of the day in order to get up and achieve another load of things the following day, then your choice is to a certain degree circumscribed. Also, if methods such as this are genuinely being used, then without proper information, without genuine knowledge of how it is that things are working around you, again, choices are, as I say, circumscribed. Proper choice can only be made when full information is available as to what is going on, and the same is true of consent. Consent is tricked out of us because we are not in full possession of the facts. It was decided to privately wage a quiet war with an ultimate objective of permanently shifting the wealth of the undisciplined and irresponsible many into the hands of the self-disciplined, responsible, and worthy few. Which is exactly what I mean there. The irresponsible many are quite possible irresponsible because they are not in possession of all of the facts. The self-disciplined, responsible, and worthy few, as they are described here, another nice bit of programming language for the inductee there. We can see the results all around us. I just outlined those, the kind of, the introduction of all sorts of sciences, all sorts of things that really are definitely not doing us any good, definitely not doing our world any good, when we know that there have been discoveries made over the same years that all of this has been turned out that would be working to our advantage. The 1939 Cancer Act, I'd say, is a classic example of this sort of thing. When discoveries are being made that might potentially be useful to people at very little cost, and with their own choice and their own resources being used to kind of get some kind of result, the best thing to do is just make it illegal, because that way people can be forced into expensive solutions that rely on industrial corporations turning out vast amounts of tackle, being treated for years and years at what appears to the public to be great cost, but in fact is generating simply a whole lot of money to be poured into the system. The objective of economic research, as conducted by the magnates of banking and the industries of goods and services, is the establishment of an economy which is totally predictable and manipulable. Low-class developments of society must be brought under total control, housebroken, trained, and assigned a yoke from a very early age before they have an opportunity to question the propriety of the matter. That, I think, is a classic example of why I think this document is worth reading, because whether or not it has been validated, or whether or not we could prove that it is what it says it certainly is describing what's going on. We talk a lot on people's internet radio about what happens to us at school from the very beginning of our education. We are taught to take on board the name, to believe that we are the name. Yes, sir, I'm here. And all through a process that was called, certainly when I was at school, it was called registration, which actually tells you that you're handing over title or superior rights of guardianship. You have to stick your hand up before you go to the toilet at school, something that can be most inconvenient. And, you know, who's got the right to tell you when you do or don't do something? These are questions that we're fairly quickly trained not to ask. Also, of course, at school, we're introduced, generally speaking, I remember I was introduced to, you know, they had policemen in to come and talk to us nicely. Uncle Bobby, as it were, in those days, priests, and there's, of course, the teachers themselves. The lower class family unit must be disintegrated. The establishment of government-operated daycare centres for the occupationally orphaned children. Well, childcare nowadays is fairly intensely government controlled. I've spoken before about people I know who are involved in daycare of children whilst both parents are out. Both parents are out functioning in society, and how it is that the people whose offspring are going to the offspring care are required to fill in quite detailed forms as to who it is that's providing that care, because of course that's been heavily fenced around with all manner of legislation, who exactly it is can do this, what qualifications they need. And then the people that are looking after the children during the day also have to fill in forms, and then there's a wee book of penalties for those who don't ensure that their data matches the data being filled in by the people who are looking after the children. So again, a chance there to pull a little bit more of the energy out of people just for filling in forms incorrectly, effectively. And as well as all the childcare, we also see children being pulled into school earlier, earlier in the day. Quite often there's after school clubs, so they get out later in the day. And there seem to me to be moves now as well to get children into school younger, so earlier in years as well as earlier in the day. And I gather there's legislation also to keep them in school longer from, I think they're trying to expand it to the age of 18. Maybe they already have, I don't know. So these are government-operated daycare centres. We might call them schools. And the idea of this is to occupationally orphan the children. Occupationally orphan children. What a fabulous phrase. Another thing I actually like about this document is I think the text is actually pretty well written. The quality of education given to the lower classes must be of the poorest sort, so that even bright lower class individuals have little, if any, hope of extricating themselves from their assigned lot. Now, one of the things that didn't exist when, I guess, this document was written was the internet. We were stuck with simply the media, with the television, the newspapers, and the education system for obtaining information. Well, nowadays, it is possible for people to inform themselves differently, and so perhaps there is a chance now to start bringing back a bit of choice and a bit of consent. And then it says, this form of slavery is essential to maintain some measure of social order, peace, and tranquility for the ruling upper class. I would add, at the total expense of any kind of social order, peace or tranquility for the people who are supplying them with everything they need. So I think we'll go to some music now. I think, Ben, as they've been talking about the ruling class, let's play the ruling class by the John Preston Tribute Band, and then we'll go into another bit of Synchro's reading, which starts into the descriptive introduction of the silent weapon and some of the general energy concepts that are involved in bringing this whole darn thing off.
Class, you can stick your ass to right. Dr. Rock's radio show. Thursday 9 p.m. to midnight on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its own manner of functioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of chemical reaction or explosion, originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder, from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of a banking magnate instead of a military general. It makes no obvious explosive noises, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily social life. Yet it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with the daily social life, unmistakable to a trained observer, one who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon, and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong, but that is because of the technical nature of the silent weapon. They cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others or defend themselves against it. When a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public adjusts and adapts to its presence and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until the psychological pressure via economic pressure becomes too great and they crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobility of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. As Mayor Amschel Rothschild said, "Give me control over a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws." Today's silent weapons technology is an outgrowth of a simple idea discovered, succinctly expressed, and effectively applied by the quoted Rothschild. Mr. Rothschild discovered the missing passive component of economic theory, known as economic inductance. He, of course, did not think of this discovery in these 20th century terms, and to be sure, mathematical analysis had to wait for the second industrial revolution, the rise of the theory of mechanics and electronics, and finally, the invention of the electronic computer before it could be effectively applied in the control of the world economy. In the study of energy systems, there always appears three elementary concepts. These are potential energy, kinetic energy, and energy dissipation. And corresponding to these concepts, there are three idealized, essentially pure physical counterparts called passive components. The first of these, in the science of physical mechanics, is the phenomenon of potential energy associated with a physical property called elasticity or stiffness and can be represented by a stretched spring. In electronic science, potential energy is stored in a capacitor instead of a spring. This property is called capacitance instead of elasticity or stiffness. The second of these in the science of physical mechanics is the phenomenon of kinetic energy, associated with a physical property called inertia or mass, and can be represented by a mass or a flywheel in motion. In electronic science, kinetic energy is stored in an inductor as in a magnetic field, instead of a mass. This property is called inductance instead of inertia. The third of these passive components in the science of physical mechanics is the phenomenon of energy dissipation associated with a physical property called friction or resistance, and can be represented by a dashpot or other device which converts energy into heat. In electronic science, dissipation of energy is performed by an element called either a resistor or a conductor, the term resistor being the one generally used to describe a more ideal device employed to convey electronic energy efficiently from one location to another. In economics, these three energy concepts are associated with economic capacitance, that is, capital or money, stock, investments in buildings and durables, etc. 2. Economic conductance, that is, goods or production flow coefficients. And 3. Economic inductance, that is, services or the influence of the population of industry on output. All of the mathematical theory developed in the study of one energy system, for example, mechanics, electronics, and so on, can be immediately applied in the study of any other energy system, for example, economics. What Mr. Rothschild had discovered was the basic principle of power, influence, and control over people as applied to economics. That principle is, when you assume the appearance of power, people soon give it to you. Mr. Rothschild had discovered that currency or deposit loan accounts had the required appearance of power that could be used to induce people into surrendering their real wealth in exchange for a promise of greater wealth instead of real compensation. They would put up real collateral in exchange for a loan of promissory notes. Mr. Rothschild found that he could issue more notes than he had backing for, so long as he had someone's stock of gold as a persuader to show his customers. Mr. Rothschild loaned his promissory notes to individuals and to governments. These would create overconfidence. Then he would make money scarce, tighten control of the system, and collect the collateral through the obligation of contracts. The cycle was then repeated. These pressures could be used to ignite a war. Then he would control the availability of currency to determine who would win the war. That government which agreed to give him control of its economic system got his support. Collection of debts was guaranteed by economic aid to the enemy of the debtor. The profit derived from this economic methodology made Mr. Rothschild all the more able to expand his wealth. He found that the public greed would allow currency to be printed by government order beyond the limits of backing in precious metal or the production of goods and services. In this structure, credit, presented as a pure element called currency, has the appearance of capital, but is in effect negative capital. Hence, it has the appearance of service, but is in fact indebtedness. It is therefore an economic inductance instead of an economic capacitance, and if balanced in no other way, will be balanced by the negation of population and war and genocide. The total goods and services represent real capital called the gross national product, and currency may be printed up to this level and still represent economic capacitance. But currency printed beyond this level is subtractive, represents the introduction of economic inductance, and constitutes notes of indebtedness. War is therefore the balancing of the system by killing the true creditors, or that has been taught to exchange true value for inflated currency, and falling back on whatever is left of the resources of nature and regeneration of those resources. Mr. Rothschild had discovered that currency gave him the power to rearrange the economic structure to his own advantage, to shift economic inductance to those economic positions which would encourage the greatest economic instability and oscillation. The final key to economic control had to wait until there was sufficient data and high-speed computing equipment to keep close watch on the economic oscillations created by price shocking and excess paper energy credits.
So we heard earlier the people, the general public, whatever we want to call them, described as undisciplined and irresponsible, as if that was a state of nature, and indeed, as if it were true of all people, when in fact we know that not all people are undisciplined, and not all people are irresponsible. I think it's also quite clear that the reason why many people may appear to be that way is because that is the way their conditioning and their education has taken them. Irresponsible is a state that is not necessarily natural to us. Perhaps in times when we were all capable of understanding the law as it stood, say when Brehon law was typical in these lands, or at a time when, before banking and the exaggeration of money rather than the retirement of it, the selling of financial instruments rather than their removal once the obligations that they represented had been fulfilled, before all of that came along, perhaps we were capable of understanding the bartering and the exchange, perhaps in the days when the same loaf of bread could be bought for the same amount of so-called money over 80 or 100 years. It was easier for us to plan for our own lives and to work out what it was we could and what it was we needed to do. Now, of course, we are led to believe that if we give somebody an aspirin or a paracetamol and it turns out to have a bit of an ugly reaction, then that ugly reaction can be pinned on us rather than unfortunate circumstances. And may many woes betide you if you should go sweeping the snow in front of your gate just in case it turns a little bit icy and somebody falls over on it. And on a larger scale, if it happens to be our responsibility, part of our contract, to prevent fraud or to prevent injury, and that contract happens to be working in a place where fraud, the causing, the execution of fraud is a habit, and the causing of injury is something that occurs all the time, and we choose to execute our responsibilities, then we've heard before on this show and on others how pretty quickly the individual who the handy meme calls a whistleblower can find themselves in deep trouble. If, for example, it is your task to ensure that an operating theatre in a hospital is to ensure that the wrong kidney is not taken out and the habit of the people around you is not to follow the various procedures and habits that are designed to prevent that sort of thing, and you bring this to your attention of your, the attention of your manager who ignores you and tells you just to get back to work, and so you tell his manager, then you may well find yourself in a position where you are constructively dismissed and end up with £30,000 worth of fines and costs against your name, costs which you are not likely to be able to meet because, having behaved in such an awful way, you're unlikely to be able to get yourself another job in style to which you've become accustomed because of your behaviour. So in many, many ways, we are encouraged to be irresponsible, which is not to say that everybody responds to that encouragement. And indeed, it is my observation that as time is going by, people are becoming more responsible rather than less so. As for undisciplined, in the odd occasions that we have chosen to get ourselves together into groups to study things, to take action, then quite often we find our activities suborned and legislated against, such that it's very difficult to keep working away at the things that you've set your mind to. Similarly, in that last section, we heard that the public cannot comprehend the silent weapon, and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by such a weapon. Well, in a world where all of the information tends to be stacked up in the other direction, we might conclude that it's not the public's comprehension that's the problem, but the fact that they do not have the information they need, or have not found the information they need to enable them to comprehend or understand what is going on around them. So it is a common belief that the economic cycle is random. It's a common belief that there actually is an economic cycle. Again, the handy meme describes it as boom and bust, when in fact it is unending bust. There has been nothing but bust and bankruptcy for hundreds of years. There is no boom. The boom is entirely an illusion. There's a tendency for people to believe that money is actual real wealth. There's a tendency to believe that the Bank of England is a national treasure instead of a private corporation trading for profit. There's a tendency to believe that the money supply is a political artifact instead of something that is being generated by our own signatures. There is a tendency to believe that the judicial system is just, fair, equitable, and to be trusted. A belief that people are free to pursue aims untravelled. A belief that taxes pay for services. A belief that, say, police officers keep the peace, or that surveillance is for our own safety and security. All of these things are constantly emphasised, and in my experience, any suggestion to the contrary tends to be pretty much reacted against. So it is not that the public cannot comprehend this weapon, it is that the public does not know that it is being operated. And if it was simply a matter of comprehension, why is it that this document emphasises several times that the ignorance of the public as to its existence is one of the most important variables in keeping the whole thing working? And because they don't comprehend it, even though they feel instinctively that something might be wrong, they do not know, it says, how to cry for help, and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it. And once again, is it a question of not knowing how to associate with others, or is it a question of being encouraged not to associate with others? I'd say that that is the case. We are actively discouraged from associating. There is, in fact, once again, a fair stack of legislation to try and ensure that association for the wrong reasons does not actually occur. And, indeed, one of the basic systems that is being used to enforce all of this is another handy meme, divide and rule. One way or the other, over the years, time and again, divisions have been driven between the members of one population and the members of another population to try and ensure that one can identify the other, and that makes it a lot easier for us not to understand each other, let alone everything else. The silent weapon, it says, attacks the vitality, options and mobility of the individuals in society. And we can see our vitality being attacked. We can see the levels of health declining, despite the fact that we're told that in the past people were less healthy and lived for less long times. We can see options being reduced more or less by the day. And as for mobility, our freedom to move from point A to point B is being interfered with on a more or less daily basis. Well, in fact, across the piece on a daily basis. And this is being done by knowing, understanding, manipulating and attacking our sources of natural and social energy. We do not have the time to generate social energy or to cooperate with each other, and our access to the natural world through enclosures, through the removal of hedges, through all manner of things is being actively reduced. As has been pointed out before, the ley lines across the lands of Albion are sight lines effectively between one site and another that can be seen from a given place, so that one could walk from point A to point B to point C, and at point C one could see where one wanted to go next. It was possible not only to navigate one's way across the landscape, but one actually had the freedom to cross the landscape. and as fences and gates and the like have been introduced, that ability has been removed from us. So much of our land was common land, I guess all of it, at one point, and now practically none of it is, and what little common land there is being removed at this very moment. So fences are being put along rivers where riverbanks used to have fairly common access to them. As I said, there were the enclosures before. There's now just public footpaths. And indeed, the public footpaths are being fairly regularly interfered with as well. There are many applications in to shut footpaths that have been open for many, many, many generations, and to ensure that people can no longer get out and about. Also, where things like the Wye Valley Walk used to have pretty much a small department of people whose responsibility it was to make sure that the stile stayed in good order and that the path stayed clear, and that people were encouraged to travel the full length of a whole river. Nowadays, there's a tendency in the councils, as they are called, to encourage simply small walks around the town, and even then, probably only for the older and less physically firm. And so our physical, mental, emotional strengths and weaknesses are also being taken advantage of. We heard there that in the science of physical mechanics, there's an important concept called energy dissipation, and this is handled by an item they call a dashpot in the text. I guess they mean a heat sink. They describe it as a device which converts energy into heat. And what's really going on here is that the energy of the people at large is being converted into resource for the people that, I keep using the word elite because they keep using the word elite. I don't think it's really a very correct word. Perhaps the emotionally light might be more accurate. And what is going on is that systems are being employed to convey energy efficiently, effectively, from one location to another. And for clarity, this is energy being transferred from the so-called lower classes to the so-called elite, from people who are not in a position of power to those with perceived authority. And the economic system, which appears to be completely at random, appears to be up and down, appears to be something over which nobody has any control and over which succeeding governments try to convince us that they will manage better than the last lot did, it would appear that it is in fact something that can be manipulated really quite freely and quite accurately. As I say, all of the mathematical theory developed in the study of, say, mechanics or electronics can be immediately applied in the study of any other energy system, which includes economics. As I've said before, the man who taught me economics when I was at school actually wrote the standard text that was being used to educate all A-level students at that point, and I'm not sure that he knew this. I think he knew more than he was teaching us, but I think that even he felt that the economic system was a bit of a hydra, and something that was always going to be difficult to manage. In fact, this appears not to be the case. And that, what a lovely simple principle it was that Mr. Rothschild discovered, the principle that when you assume the appearance of power, people soon give it to you. And that's very important, because that principle means, of course, that, as is said so often on people's internet radio, the power is ours to give. And of course we see it working not only, you know, in the upper echelons and political power and council power and whatever power else is being executed around us. Many people now are finding that just by putting a fluorescent jacket on and carrying a clipboard can give you a fair amount of power and influence over those around you. I gather there have been some pretty spectacular thefts committed recently by people turning up with a bunch of scaffolding, some fluoro jackets, and a bunch of clipboards, and say dismantling a wall on a supermarket and making off with the cash machine that's in the wall. And there were no bits of paper required there, not really. All there was people's tendency to do what they're told by somebody who is wearing a fluorescent jacket. So nowadays, I guess we might say that the appearance of power can be assumed simply by the clothes that you wear. And then once you've assumed a position of power, so these descriptions of people in authority, people in positions of power, this is only apparently the case, and it only remains apparently the case whilst people give their power away. But once somebody is in a position of authority, Mr. Rothschild discovered that people would put up real collateral in exchange for a loan of promissory notes. And of course, the exchange of promissory notes generally nearly always, in fact probably always, involves obligations and duties being taken on board as a result of contracts. And as we know, the administrative system, from police stops through social services and education to voting and the benefit system, is entirely a matter of contract after contract after contract. And then the other thing I remember that surprised me really quite a lot when I heard it was that both sides of a war are in fact financed by the same people. Of course, all that makes a lot more sense when one realises that effectively there's very, very few people who actually run the money machines. And so, if given that wars must be paid for, when one power controls all the money creation, it must be, by definition, financing both sides. And in this particular case, we hear that the collection of debts is guaranteed by economic aid to the enemy of the debtor. So you can lend money to one side, and then you can help out the other side, and that way you make sure that you never actually lose at all. Rothschild also found that public greed would allow currency to be printed beyond the limits of backing in precious metal and the production of goods and services. So here we see something else that we're very used to talking about on People's Internet Radio, that in this structure, currency has the appearance of capital. It has the appearance of something real and tangible, but is in effect negative capital. It has the appearance of service, but is in fact indebtedness. And if balanced in no other way, it will be balanced by killing the true creditors, it says, the creditors being the public that has been taught to exchange true value for inflated currency. So again, hidden away in the language is the admission, really, of all of these truths. One of the truths, of course, is that the people that are being killed in the war are the true creditors, as Pat is constantly saying on Scotland is Free on a Monday night. All of the equity that we come across is ours. The debt is not ours. We are the creditors. We are the people to whom it is all owed. And here we see it in black and white, or in the case of this, blue and white. But hey, what's the difference? Mr. Rothschild had discovered that currency gave him the power to rearrange the economic structure and to shift economic inductance, i.e. the potential energy of the many, all of us, into economic positions which would encourage the greatest economic instability and oscillation. So whilst we are promised security and stability, for a start-off it's never achieved. And if what's happening is that the entire system is being used to encourage instability and oscillation, it's not entirely surprising that it's never achieved. We're always told that these things are on the horizon. There will always be jam tomorrow. And tomorrow, as we know, genuinely never comes. But all of this is happening because when people turn up in front of us with the appearance of power, we readily give it to them. As is being shown time and again by people encountering these apparent authorities, people in uniforms, people with wigs, when a man actually stands in front of them and starts asking questions and effectively behaves in a way not to cede that power, then things start to happen differently. And that, of course, is why it's so important that these silent weapons remain a secret and that the people that are being taught about them remain as silent as the weapons they're being taught to use. This is why the people who wrote this document, if it is what it claims to be, are so nervous about the information that's getting out. And of course, for us It's not just theory. I have myself, and I'm sure that many of you have as well, heard plenty of interviews on People's Internet Radio and before it TNS and before it and MSI of people who have chosen to take the other path, and things work out very, very differently once that turns out to be the case. So no matter how far this system has taken us, no matter how good it appears to be at fulfilling the function that it's set out to fulfill, there is most definitely light at the end of the tunnel. And as the system becomes more insane, or as the apparent reality of these silent weapons becomes ever more clear to ever greater numbers of people, then the chances of changing it, the chances of moving the system towards the public wheel, or the wheel of the people instead of the wheel of the few, gets ever greater. And it seems clear that at this point, never has it been more important that that is what we start to do. And it is our choice. It is entirely our choice. It's very easy to lay responsibility for all of this at the feet of others. It is very easy to say that the information was not available and we don't know what we're doing. But nowadays, the information is there. There are techniques, there are solutions, but most of all, it is to do with us assuming our own responsibility. So I have another wee chunk of music now, I think. We'll play Nobody's Fault But Mine off No Quarter before returning to Synchro's reading and hear a little bit about the breakthroughs that led to all of this stuff being able to be applied to economics and how economics is really only a social extension of a natural energy system.
You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. And because the surgery team are unavailable for live comment tonight, we've been listening to readings from and comments upon Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, a document that was found back in the 80s in a second-hand photocopier. And now we will hear Synchro telling us about how it was that the aviation industry was responsible for a breakthrough in the art of completely manipulable economics.
Aviation field provided the greatest evolution in economic engineering by way of the mathematical theory of shock testing. In this process, a projectile is fired from an airframe on the ground, and the impulse of the recoil is monitored by vibration transducers connected to the airframe and wired to chart recorders. By studying the echoes or reflections of the recoil impulse in the airframe, it is possible to discover critical vibrations in the structure of the airframe, which either vibrations of the engine or aeolian vibrations of the wings, or a combination of the two, might reinforce, resulting in a resonant self-destruction of the airframe in flight. From the standpoint of engineering, this means that the strengths and weaknesses of the structure of the airframe in terms of vibrational energy can be discovered and manipulated. To use this method of airframe shock testing in economic engineering, the prices of commodities are shocked and the public consumer reaction is monitored. The resulting echoes of the economic shock are interpreted theoretically by computers, and the psycho-economic structure of the economy is thus discovered. It is by this process that partial, differential, and difference matrices are discovered that define the family household and make possible its evaluation as an economic industry. Then the response of the household to future shocks can be predicted and manipulated, and society becomes a well-regulated animal with its reins under the control of a sophisticated, computer-regulated social energy bookkeeping system. Eventually, every individual element of the structure comes under computer control through a knowledge of personal preferences. Such knowledge is guaranteed by computer association of consumer preferences through universal product or barcodes on packages, with consumers identified via association by the use of credit card, and later a permanent tattooed body number, invisible under normal ambient illumination. Economics is only a social extension of a natural energy system. It also has its three passive components. Because of the distribution of wealth and the lack of communication and data, this field has been the last energy field for which a knowledge of these three passive components has been developed. Since energy is the key to all activity on the face of the earth, it follows that in order to attain a monopoly of energy, raw materials, goods and services, and to establish a world system of slave labour, it is necessary to have a first strike capability in the field of economics. In order to maintain our position, it is necessary that we have absolute first knowledge of the science of control over all economic factors and the first experience at engineering the world economy. In order to achieve such sovereignty, we must at least achieve this one end, that the public will not make either the logical or mathematical connection between economics and the other energy sciences, or learn to apply such knowledge. This is becoming increasingly difficult to control because more and more businesses are making demands upon their computer programmers to create and apply mathematical models for the management of those businesses. It is only a matter of time before the new breed of private programmer or economist will catch on to the far-reaching implications of the work begun at Harvard in 1948. The speed with which they can communicate their warning to the public will largely depend upon how effective we have been at controlling the media, subverting education, and keeping the public distracted with matters of no real importance. Economics as a social energy science has, as its first objective, the description of the complex way in which any given unit of resources is used to satisfy some economic want, as expressed in the Leontief matrix. This first objective, when it is extended to get the most product from the least or limited resources, comprises that objective of general military and industrial logistics known as operations research. The Harvard Economic Research Project in 1948 was an extension of World War II operations research. Its purpose was to discover the science of controlling an economy. At first the American economy, and then the world economy. It was felt that with sufficient mathematical foundation and data, it would be nearly as easy to predict and control the trend of an economy as to predict and control the trajectory of a projectile. Such has proven to be the case. Moreover, the economy has been transformed into a guided missile on target. The immediate aim of the Harvard Project was to discover the economic structure, what forces change that structure, how the behaviour of the structure can be predicted, and how it can be manipulated. What was needed was a well-organised knowledge of the mathematical structures and interrelationships of investment, production, distribution, and consumption. To make a short story of it all, it was discovered that an economy obeyed the same laws as electricity, and that all of the mathematical theory and practical and computer know-how developed for the electronic field could be directly applied in the study of economics. This discovery was not openly declared, and its more subtle implications were and are kept a closely guarded secret. For example, that in an economic model, human life is measured in dollars, and that the electric spark generated when opening a switch connected to an active inductor is mathematically analogous to the initiation of war. The greatest hurdle which theoretical economists faced was the accurate description of the household as an industry. This is a challenge because consumer purchases are a matter of choice, which in turn is influenced by income, price, and other economic factors. This hurdle was cleared in an indirect and statistically approximate way by an application of shock testing to determine the current characteristics of a household industry. Finally, because problems in theoretical electronics can be translated very easily into problems of theoretical economics, and the solution translated back again, it follows that only a book of language translation and concept definition needed to be written for economics. The remainder could be gotten from standard works on mathematics and electronics. This makes the publication of books on advanced economics unnecessary and greatly simplifies project security.
So in that little section, we heard that at some point during this process, it was discovered that economies effectively obey the same laws as electricity, and that all of the mathematical theory and all of the practical and computer know-how that's been developed for the electronic field could be directly applied in the study of economics. And of course, we don't have to look very hard to see just how advanced our understanding of electronics is nowadays. Nearly everything that, or many, certainly many, many things that used to be performed by human beings, by men and women, can now be performed by, say, robots that are controlled via means of processors and chips of one sort or another, and that all of these things can be easily written down and communicated by means of schematics and technical manuals. And so bit by bit, we've seen entire factories that used to use hundreds of men and women to produce cars or vehicles have been more or less entirely converted into systems that can be run by computers and various machines. Same thing with the sorting of rubbish. I remember from last year's interview with the rubbish collectors at the fire in the mountain festival that many of the things that they were originally doing using human beings, bit by bit, various bits of tackle were introduced which could dry cans out and crush them, could sort one thing from another. And that as a result of that, we're now seeing a lot of long-standing recycling systems that were established experimentally by individuals who believed that the recycling of rubbish was a good thing in Wales round and about, are now being closed down because as a result of the activities of those men and women, the machines were developed, purchased, tested, and run for a considerable length of time until such time as single industrial plants can now be run where you basically pour a load of rubbish in one end and what comes out the other end apparently is sorted stuff that can then be, I don't know, upcycled, whatever it is they do with it. Maybe having done that, they just take it all away and landfill it. I don't know. But one way or the other, electronics has taken over so many different applications that used to have a brain and a couple of sets of fingers at the end of it. Telephone exchanges. I'm sure the number of examples are absolutely huge. The challenge of actually dealing with the data, as it were, the input data of the economy in order to get predictable outputs such as we see being obtained from electronics has been more or less overcome. The challenge remained, therefore, to ensure that the inputs were as accurate as possible, because the more input there can be and the more accurate it can be and the more in real time it can be gathered, then the more effective the control of the economy can be on a mathematical basis. And we heard what the aim is in terms of inputs in a very nice pithy little paragraph, which said broadly that eventually every individual element of the structure should come under computer control through a knowledge of personal preferences. Such knowledge is guaranteed by computer association of consumer preferences through the use of barcodes on packaging, with consumers being identified via association with the use of a credit card and later a permanent tattooed body number invisible under normal ambient illumination. Now, at the time when the document was written, as was described there, it was only really possible to treat these input data as a whole system. So basically by delivering shocks to the economic system, by making something scarce or by putting the price up, and then seeing how the entire population responded to that across the piece, really, by seeing how people's buying habits changed, by seeing how advertising changed and then how people responded to the change in advertising. It was also, it turned out, possible to see how these various shocks related one thing to another. They could basically shock one thing, see how everybody responded, and then take one of the items that changed and shock that and see how it worked the other way round. And the aim of all of this is to attain a monopoly of energy, raw materials, goods and services, and to establish a world system of slavery. And in order to do that, it was necessary, and once again, this is an interesting emphasis, I think, that the public does not make either the logical or mathematical connection between economics and the other energy sciences, or learn to apply such knowledge. Now here we are, many years down the line, and of course it's no longer necessary to use those techniques they learned from the aviation industry. It's no longer necessary to study the effects of labour strikes when people aren't collecting rubbish or when power isn't supplied for, you know, many days at a time, because nowadays the computer inventions that were described at the very beginning of all of this have enabled all sorts of things that were not possible then. So we have barcodes now generally on pretty much everything, credit and debit cards, we've got loyalty cards, computerized banking, internet shopping. All of these things actually help to ensure that in the purchases of individuals, what people are buying under any given circumstance can be associated with individuals. So the detail of the input has now increased no end. I remember being pretty puzzled when I was buying stuff from for use in the garden, to be asked constantly whether I was going to pay cash or have it on account. And of course accounts are another very good way of keeping track of what individuals are doing. And nowadays I'm aware that out there there's a thing called a cash account, which means that even though one is buying something with cash, it is possible if one opens one of these things, and of course what you're offered is a bit of a discount, sometimes a pretty substantial discount on the price of what is being bought, to encourage you to use one of these accounts. And I remember thinking at the time, well, that's a very strange thing to be doing, and it's a benefit which I have successfully resisted so far, in as far as when one is buying with cash, there are no details handed over as to who it is that's buying it or where they live or what it is that they've been bought or anything. But of course that is one of the things that cash accounts will achieve, is to keep track even of stuff that is not being bought with a debit or a credit card. We also have the choice, do we not, as to whether we take a loyalty card or not. It's always seemed to me, and to St. Croix it has to be said, that the benefits of such things were really not worth the candle. I don't know what you get on them now, but in those days it was kind of 0.0001 of a penny for every pound you spent or something like that. Now it's been taken one step further in that we have these contactless payment systems, as it says, I think, doesn't it say something like cash, only easier? Well, like cash, only providing a whole lot more information. And again, we get that concern that the public might get to understand or make the connection between these various things that are going on. And certainly, even if the population in general weren't making that conclusion, it was getting to the point where individual companies or enterprises that were running their own computerized stock control systems and all the rest of it got to the point where they wanted to start doing the kind of analysis which was being dreamed of by the people that came up with the silent weapons. And it was concluded that the speed with which they are going to be able to communicate any kind of warning to the public will largely depend upon how effective we, the developers of the silent weapons, have been at controlling the media, subverting education, and keeping the public distracted with matters of no real importance. There again is an absolute key point, I think, don't you agree? That it is distraction, once again, distraction, keeping people undisciplined, keeping people irresponsible, keeping people inattentive to the detail of what is actually going on around them. And this is done through use of the TV and the media. It's also done through use of video games, of movies. I mean, the situation we heard of earlier where the system is effectively firing situations that are controlled by data and by computer programmers instead of actually firing guns that are fired by gunpowder and all the rest of it, was one of the major changes that was made. Well, I'm reliably informed that our systems respond pretty much to movies and television programs and the like as if they were real. So it's not just the data that's being used. All of this stuff can be fed back to us through films and through our entertainment systems, and especially through computer programs. And it is apparently as real as if it was absolutely real. And people, all of us, I think, to a certain extent, it's very difficult to sometimes sort distraction from actuality. But the kind of attention that's now being paid by all manner of people to the removal of people from their houses and the attempt to get them to, I don't know, live on the streets or in a field or whatever, is showing that people are starting to pay attention to the things that really do matter. And eviction, or as it's probably more accurately called, repossession, or as it's even more accurately called, actual possession of goods, is an important matter. Brothers and sisters, people, men and women, are having items taken off them, which, as it turns out later in the document we get to hear, is one of the fundamental aims of all of this. And this might be, you know, in some cases people might have paid an enormous amount of money towards the house, but because of not being able to make it for 2 or 3 or 4 months or whatever, then they not only lose their house, but they lose all of the equity that they've invested in it as well. There might be 100, 150, 160,000, who knows what it is. Enormous amounts of time, energy and investment are represented by the many years of successful payment. And it's not only the house that goes, but it's all of that effort at all. And it doesn't seem to be occurring to a lot of people in our so-called society that this is in any way unfair. In fact, a basic approach of most people seems to be to shrug their shoulders and not even to give it the benefit of the there, but for the grace of God, go I, thought. And this is so important compared with what's going to be happening on the next soap opera, or what it is that the papers are claiming the government is or is not trying to do. There are people out there who are committing suicide because of an illusory debt which is not theirs. That is important. There's usury, the usury which is at the base of absolutely everything. I mean, the more I think about the kind of subjects that we talk about here, the more often I find myself returning to the money, to the nature of money, to the way it's being used as fundamentally at the base of the whole thing. And yet most people go, well, you know, there has to be interest, doesn't there? Because the bank's got to be able to make their money somewhere. Well, if you look at it, the banks are making money absolutely hand over fist. Even if it did end up turning out that apparently they didn't have any left and had to have many tens of millions put more poured into their coffers. But it's also apparent that the banks are fraudulent in all sorts of ways, not just the recent discoveries of HSBC stashing things away in Switzerland on behalf of private customers, or HSBC again, although I've no doubt, or I'm pretty sure that others are probably involved as well in laundering Mexican drug money. But more obviously, these things that are called mis-selling, you know, the endowments which didn't turn out to be what they were. So, you know, you can make all the money back on the house and actually have a chunk at the end of it that you'll be able to go out and spend. Whereas, in fact, everybody I know who took an endowment out has ended up owing a substantial chunk of extra money. Or payment protection insurance, that's what they called it, isn't it? The split capital investment trust, the manipulation of LIBOR, and then subsequently the manipulation, it became apparent, the manipulation of all other interest rates. All of these things are effectively frauds, which any of us, if any of us were caught actually committing them, then we'd find ourselves in deep trouble, because they're all systems which are causing harm, loss and damage to the everyday man on the street. These are important things. The fact that even though we might not have been fighting wars in Europe for the last, it's not that long, is it? The last 80 years or so. Not even that. Hang on, my maths is really poor when I'm thinking on my feet here. Say 60 years. There may not have been wars in Europe, but my memory of my life is that there are wars being fought all the time. And now we know that rather than there being mostly combatants or soldiers who may or may not have wanted to be where they were, rather than the deaths being largely amongst the people who are actually waging the war, nowadays it is largely civilians, it's largely men and women and children who are being killed. All of these things are the important things. These are the things which it would, I'm sure, behove us to start thinking about and start changing behaviours, changing consents, changing choices once again, rather than concentrating on the matters of no real importance, which is what the developers of the silent weapons would have us concentrating on. We also heard reference there to the Leontiev Matrix, which is something I've looked into a bit. It's not frightfully exciting, it has to be said, except that it is, does seem to be the primary system for providing a link between the input data and the actual manipulation of the economy, such that given predictable manipulated outputs can be predicted. And apparently Leontiev was a mathematician who devoted his studies to an economic input-output analysis for the economy, for the American economy specifically. And whilst a professor at Harvard, which is where this study was set up, the Harvard Economic Research Project, which we heard earlier, was covered by a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation and subsequently by the United States Air Force, he did successfully manage to come up with this matrix. This apparently has been developed into a software program that now runs the IRS mainframe, and its latest manifestation, I gather, has become a thing known as the Federal Acquisition Regulation, which is, when you go and look at it, if you stick that into your favourite search engine, it will come up with an absolutely huge document showing that there is now a link between the purchasing, the manufacturing of stuff, and the consumer base, which then uses all the stuff that's being purchased and manufactured. Some people now call it the Federal Acquisition Regulation Matrix, or FARM. Ha ha ha! Get it? That's clever, isn't it? And also, the Leontiev, as by which the Leontiev Matrix is named, was the director of the Harvard Economic Research Project, from which all of this sprang. The hope, as they say, was that it was felt that with sufficient mathematical foundation and data, it would be nearly as easy to predict and control the trend of an economy as to predict and control the trajectory of a projectile. And again, we can see really how we're being seriously misled there, because again, my impression when looking at the odd occasion I do look at economic data in newspapers and the like, or from the behaviour that I've frequently described in private eye, it would appear that the economy is pretty much a wild thing that is neither controllable nor predictable. And it was said that the greatest hurdle which theoretical economists faced was the accurate description of the household as an industry, and that challenge arose because consumer purchases, what we all buy and use, are a complex matter of choice that are influenced by so many different variables that it was extremely difficult to get a handle on it. Well, the airframe testing from the aviation industry got them a little bit around that problem, but nowadays, with all the things I listed just a few minutes ago, this is no longer really a problem. Plus, of course, we now have, we've now got Facebook, telephone records and all manner of other things. We'll hopefully get a chance at some stage later to have a quick look at the various ways that input data is being augmented, so that it's not only purchases, it is almost every piece of information that we are willingly yielding that is making all of this possible. And then there's the ideal situation. They discovered that because problems in theoretical electronics can be translated very easily into the problems of theoretical economics, it wasn't even necessary to write any more books. All it was to translate the terms that were being used in electronics into terms that might be effectively used in economics. And that is basically the part of the subject that is covered by the various industrial and technical diagrams that turn up in this. It shows purportedly how it is that electronics and differential calculus and the rest can be used to, via the Leontiev matrix, to connect inputs and outputs. And another very important thing that they managed to do, finally, was to, as a result of all of this, was to define the household itself, the home, as we might call it, as an industry. And through the gathering, control, and application of information, the people of Earth are now effectively one industry, and their energy is being ruthlessly and systematically converted and harvested to the benefit of the self-disciplined, responsible, and worthy few.
Thank you for choosing Bastard MasterCard. We offer a competitive debt repayment scheme which will ensure you have less than nothing forever. Your house, your car, your cat, and your dog is at risk if you do not keep up repayments. Annual percentage rate currently at 475%. Terms and conditions apply.
Out in a hole with just the doll to keep me in the black. My letterbox was full of bills and I began to crack. I shouted at my TV and my TV answered back. If you join the New World Order, son, there's nothing you will lack. They offered me that MasterCard they call the Golden Gun. It's universal plastic, it's every card in one. Spends your money for you, then tells you what you've done. And debits you a pound of flesh for every hour of fun. So I ain't gonna take that card, I ain't gonna drop my guard. I ain't gonna lose my right to choose, although the times are hard. I ain't gonna punch my profile in so they can tell me where I've been. I ain't gonna take that bastard MasterCard. And have you seen that laser beam? The one that knows your car. You tell it where you wanna go, it tells them where you are. With automatic debiting for every inch of tar. And an access code for every road, or you ain't gonna get that far. So I ain't gonna take that card, I ain't gonna drop my guard. I ain't gonna lose my right to choose, although the times are hard. I won't give away my DNA to drive along no motorway. Ain't gonna take that bastard MasterCard. I called my money manager, she said, you're in a fix. We'll put you on our debit scheme, it's called the 666. It only takes a drop of blood, it's just a little prick. And then we can peep inside your jeans and see what makes you tick. So I ain't gonna take that card, I ain't gonna drop my guard. I ain't gonna lose my right to choose, although the times are hard. I know microchip will say that I have not the right to sell or buy. I ain't gonna take that bastard MasterCard. Did you hear about that master plan they call the Master Race? With an oh-so-easy barcode implanted in your face. You will only get one if you got the DNA. And you got to stay in credit just to earn your living space. So I ain't gonna take that card, I ain't gonna drop my guard. I ain't gonna lose my right to choose, although the times are hard. An old digital geneticist will even know that I exist. I ain't gonna take that bastard MasterCard. Did you hear about that man who said it couldn't happen here? I sang this song to warn him, but he didn't wanna hear. He said, DNA's the price I pay for living with no fear. Then when he got home, he met his clone with a grin from ear to ear. So I ain't gonna take that card, I ain't gonna drop my guard. I ain't gonna lose my right to choose, although the times are hard. I don't give a damn what you think I'm worth, I have the right to walk this earth. I ain't gonna take that bastard master, don't wanna use that bastard master. I'm gonna take that bastard master card.
Jakey Z there and his cover version of Seize the Day's Bastard MasterCard.
So, we're told that a social welfare program is a credit balance system which creates false capital to give non-productive people a roof over their heads and food in their stomachs. And of course, I suppose we are supposed to understand by this the benefit system, as it is called, which is effectively concealing the bankruptcy of the system by feeding just enough extra currency or money
to people who, as a result of the way the system is designed, are finding it extremely difficult to make ends meet. I suppose we are supposed to understand by this that the non-productive people are the ones who are signing on to the benefit system and through their signatures actually creating currency. Currency which is subsequently inflated, hypothecated and counterfeited to levels far, far beyond those that are actually being fed back into the people's hands. We're told that the recipients become state property in return for what is called a gift. Well, it's not, of course, a gift. It is, as Pat says, simply a means-tested return of a tiny, oh-so-tiny portion of the equity that is represented by the individuals concerned. It's also, I think, possible to look at it another way, isn't it? I mean, who are genuinely the non-productive people in this particular system, when all of the work is being done, all of the roads are being built, all of the food is being grown and driven about the place, all of the houses are being built, all of the physical work is being done by the people. The truly non-productive, I would suggest, are the people who are running the banking system and the insurance systems and the auditing systems, and indeed the emotionally lights themselves, who sit at the top of the pile, who are being non-productive. They are the people who are getting all of the value and taking it unto themselves, as it were. And it's pointed out that people who become hooked on the economic drug must go to the elite for a fix. That is because all of the equity is being appropriated, and because we are not able to trade amongst ourselves with the equity of our own lives, our own labours, our own skills, and such like. This economic system is a drug. That's a very accurate description of it. It's been said before that a line of credit is little different, really, from a line of cocaine, in as far as when one becomes hooked on something like cocaine or heroin, it becomes absolutely essential to continue to chase your fix day after day after day. And we don't have to look at the behaviour of people very hard to see that money actually works in a very, very similar way. The idea of economic inductance is really important in all of this. I guess perhaps it's worth just kind of reviewing it again. Elsewhere in the document, it points out that economic inductance represents the inertia of an economic value in motion, and it's a phenomenon known as services. It's a kind of economic flywheel. It's what puts the energy into the system and keeps it all spinning along. As such, the social welfare program, such as it is called, presents something of an alternative to war as an economic inductor, as is pointed out elsewhere in the document. This is also true of things such as enormous open-ended space programs, because they're all kind of chucking money in motion into the system. And I should imagine the same thing can be said of large house building projects. And we know, don't we, that certainly in Ireland, and I think elsewhere in the world, huge numbers of houses have been built that are being left empty, despite the fact that people are being evicted from their homes or domiciles. And in terms of electrical inductance, a secondary product of what's going on is a magnetic field. So you have current, and then you have a magnetic field that is generated. As far as this particular economic theory goes, the flow of economic value represents the kind of current, and the secondary phenomenon, that of the magnetic field, is represented by a population. And when the flow of money diminishes, the human population field collapses in order to keep the money flowing. When they say the population field collapses, this is where the war comes in. As the flow of real value reduces, it is necessary to reduce the population through which it is flowing. So when an electrical current is reduced, the corresponding magnetic field becomes smaller. And when the flow of, I guess, real economic value, as opposed, of course, to inflated or counterfeited value is reduced, it is the population that must be reduced. And so it is that we hear again that the system must eventually resort to war to balance the account, because war ultimately, once again, is merely the act of destroying the creditor, and the politicians are the publicly hired hitmen to justify the act, to keep the responsibility and blood off the public conscience. And it is keeping it only off the conscience, because to a great extent, as long as money is being handed over to a system which works this way, then we, or the people who are paying the money into the system, are responsible for the output of that system. It was made clear there also that we are effectively being fooled by a system which changes regularly to maintain the reputations of politicians, such that the reality of the situation never really quite catches up with them. And this again has been done over time in many different ways: the changing of weights and measures, the changing of currencies, the changing of the way statistics are taken, the way things are measured, the way things are expressed, means that it's possible in the limited political life of somebody who's doing this sort of thing, it's possible to keep everything looking reasonable until such time as those politicians have moved on and another lot come in, and by then the situation has changed again. The system's also changed by printing money to create self-confidence, false self-confidence, and to continue to be able to satisfy the so-called greed of the people. And once again, I think we have to question just exactly where the greed actually is in this system. It says if the people really cared about the fellow men, they would control their appetites, greed, procreation, etc., so that they would not have to operate on a credit or welfare social system which steals from the worker to satisfy the bum. Well, who is the worker? Who is the bum? Is a question that I feel we should all be asking ourselves. Also, as the system seems to be reaching some kind of climax at the moment, it's perhaps also worth asking how it has come about that a lot of the social welfare is now going to people who are actually working. So we see a lot of tax credits. I know a lot of my friends are on tax credits. That it means that really the welfare system has been expanded beyond people who simply have no throughput of currency, who have no means for one reason or another of actually earning enough to buy the bread to put on the table. This is where the welfare system was fundamentally operating originally, and now it seems to be operating throughout the economy. It seems that people require help to pay for their council tax. Maybe people require help to pay for their rent. People are requiring help to pay for the care of their children in these government-sponsored daycare centres or with other carers during the day. And so, if you like, these benefits are being moved further up the system, and that is leaving other people right down the bottom to be classified as non-productive. In fact, though, the economic flywheel that is the benefit system is just becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And as it gets harder and harder to survive in an ever more expensive world, it is becoming necessary for more and more people to take the so-called gift of the state. And as it points out, in return for this gift, these people become a standing army for the elite, because at least in the opinions of the people writing this document, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And of course, he who pays the piper should be calling the tune, but once again we have to ask ourselves, who is the piper and who is actually paying? And since most of the general public will not exercise restraint, largely we have to point out because their choice and ability to do so is being constantly robbed from them or given away by them. There are only two alternatives to reduce the economic inductance of the system. The first is to let the populace bludgeon each other to death in war, which will only result in the total destruction of the living earth. Do the population really want to bludgeon each other to death in war? How much of war is being encouraged or created by false borders that are put all over the map so that people are effectively kind of trapped within a given region, within a theatre in which the main method of dividing and ruling can then be operated to ensure that one side can recognise another side and that then violence and mayhem can be encouraged amongst them. My own experience of people, as I've said before, is that they actually want to learn to sing each other's songs, cook each other's food and dance each other's dances. I suspect that most of the people actually just want to get on with each other. Why it is that we've got war, whether it is indeed human nature to be doing this, is, I think, a matter that is very much open to question. Certainly it would appear that it has not always been the case on the planet. And whilst the kind of high-level economic control that we're talking about here might be fairly recent, civilization, as we might call it, civilization itself, in the form of religion, conscription, law, weapons, slavery, has been around since at least the time of Sumer. And as such, there has, I would guess, been a fair degree of control and stimulation of the habits and mores of populations for a very, very long time indeed. The other alternative is to take control of the world by the use of economic silent weapons in a form of quiet warfare and reduce the economic inductance of the world to a safe level by a process of benevolent slavery and genocide. Well, in fact, it would seem, would it not, that those are not genuine alternatives. It would seem that both of those things are being done, that the control of the world by the use of economic weapons is one of the things that's going on, and the populace is being encouraged to bludgeon each other to death in war as well. And the methods that are being used to reduce the economic inductance of the system are themselves resulting in the destruction of the living earth, as was pointed out earlier. The general public refuses to improve its own mentality and its faith in its fellow man. It has become a herd of proliferating barbarians and, so to speak, a blight upon the face of the earth. Well, surely all of this is a result of the system that we've been looking at this evening. What is coming out of the television, what is coming out of the newspapers, what is coming out of the education system is all stuff which is conditioning and training people to manifest the kind of characteristics that are being described here. I don't think it can necessarily be accepted per se as a state of nature. And I suppose it's also worth pointing out that the inductee that has been selected to read this document and to become part of this system is as much being programmed by it as being informed. And all of these are highly weighted expressions suggesting that the people are the dead weight and that the actual productive entities are the folk at the top who are coming up with these systems and then enforcing them. It seems highly likely that an instrument such as the television could be used completely differently to ensure that people are being given access to, I don't know, technical creativity, to the information that they do need to make moral, ethical and logical decisions. Is it entirely fair to be laying out criticisms along these lines when the education system is not giving people the ability, the tools they need to think and to analyse what is being said and to come up with conclusions that might be for the betterment of the individual, and as a result of being for the betterment of the individual, perhaps the betterment of the way the society works as well? And in the conclusion of that last section it said, it is left to those few who are truly willing to think and survive as the fittest to survive, to solve the problem for themselves as the few who really care. The few who really care. Goodness me. They have no understanding of irony, these people. Otherwise, it says, exposure of the silent weapon would destroy our only hope of preserving the seed of the future true humanity. Well, I wonder what would be happening if the genius and enthusiasm and the love that is apparent amongst many, many people in the wider population were actually given rein, if we actually had access to, as I said, our own skills, our own abilities, and the resulting input that comes from us exercising those, to be able to reinvest those in further development of our own skills and output. I wonder what the world would be like then. This document seems to fail to take into account that the world we are looking at results from the exercise of exactly such immoral, unethical, and emotionally unsound approaches. And I think it is by now abundantly clear that this system, as it stands and as described, is designed to run entirely on the principle of debt. And that the debt that it's running on is a loan against the security of future generations of men and women, our children and their children and their children after them. One of the aims stated in the list of outputs contained within Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars is the desire and ability to allocate and destroy opportunities. Indeed, these are the first two strategies or statements of intent in a list of 32 such statements. The influence and ability to achieve these aims arises from the administrative and practical control of the economic environment, of the availability of raw materials, of capital, of bank rates, of the inflation of currency, the possession of property, of industrial capacity, of manufacturing, control of the availability of goods and commodities, control of the prices of commodities, control of services, the labour force, control of payments to government officials, control of legal functions, control of personal data files, control of advertising and media contact, and the material available for TV viewing. Control of the design of more probing tax forms and censuses and other information systems. Control of surveillance. Control of the storage of information. Control of sociological factors and control of health functions. These are all statements of intent in this, these short lists of outputs that's also included in the document. So the control of all of these other things leads to the ability to allocate opportunities to one set of people and to destroy the opportunities of others. And of course this can flip-flop around. It's possible to allocate opportunities for a given length of time and then suddenly pull the rug away and destroy those opportunities. Again, part of the economic cycle apparently, but in fact something that is really being quite heavily prescribed and controlled. So this kind of extensive control is being used, it should be apparent by now, directly to disengage attention from real issues, to engage emotional responses, and to create disorder, chaos, and insanity. And it is fundamentally an emotional rather than a moral or ethical or logical response that tends to arise in the many when any of this subject matter is brought to their attention by folk who have become aware that democracy and the so-called free market economy are built fundamentally on consent, on the consent and choice of the many. Those consents and choices are to accept and facilitate by action or inaction, usury, slavery, murder, fraud, and in the end, the theft of everything that is ours by right. And the individuals classed as non-productive in the last piece that we heard from Synchro are so because they are engaged with a bureaucracy, a world of forms and data transmission in which most folk have become office workers who are feeding information to a system which is really interested only in either their enslavement or their demise. They're also unproductive because of distraction, because of limitation of opportunity, and just because of the outrageous cost of an interest-bearing and heavily taxed existence, which is something that certainly has not always been the case. And I think things probably ran a lot better before all of this energy was being sucked out. And it's not impossible to imagine a world based on principle rather than debt, a world based on the creation of opportunity rather than its destruction, a world perhaps based on encouragement through improved education, of technical creativity, of knowledge and care for the needs of others rather than ignorance of them, rather than the world as is described in this document, which has a modus operandi which preys on weaknesses, cripples strength, and leeches wealth and substance to where it is going to be least useful. The silent weapon is directly corrupting, depraving, and destroying humanity, and to describe the humanity that's resulting from that in the terms of the document is, it seems to me, deeply unfair, but hey, nobody said it was going to be fair, did they? Subsequent to this, that chunk that we've just heard, there's more technical pages here. They reveal circuits that are equivalent to industries and all of the various schematics that relate one industry to another. But as I said earlier, I'm only really interested here in the words. For people who do want to see the diagrams and the rest, full copies of the document can be got from either lawfulpath.com or stopthecrime.net. So over to Synchro's last bit for the show, really. This is the kind of pièce de la résistance at the end of the document, when these folk really show themselves in their true colours.
Experience has proved that the simplest method of securing a silent weapon and gaining control of the public is to keep the public undisciplined and ignorant of the basic system principles on the one hand, while keeping them confused, disorganized, and distracted with matters of no real importance on the other hand. This is achieved by disengaging their minds, sabotaging their mental activities, providing a low-quality program of public education in mathematics, logic, systems design, and economics, and discouraging technical creativity. By engaging their emotions, increasing their self-indulgence and their indulgence in emotional and physical activities by unrelenting emotional affrontations and attacks, or mental and emotional rape, by way of constant barrage of sex, violence and wars in the media, especially the TV and the newspapers, and by giving them what they desire in excess, junk food for thought, and depriving them of what they really need. By rewriting history and law, and subjecting the public to the deviant creation, thus being able to shift their thinking from personal needs to highly fabricated outside priorities. These preclude their interest in and discovery of the silent weapons of social automation technology. The general rule is that there is a profit in confusion. The more confusion, the more profit. Therefore, the best approach is to create problems and then offer solutions. So in the media, keep the adult public attention diverted away from the real social issues and captivated by matters of no real importance. In schools, keep the young public ignorant of real mathematics, real economics, real law, and real history. In entertainment, keep the public entertainment below a sixth grade level. And at work, keep the public busy, 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 with no time to think, back on the farm with the other animals. A silent weapon system operates upon data obtained from a docile public by legal, but not always lawful, force. Much information is made available to silent weapon systems programmers through the Internal Revenue Service. This information consists of the enforced delivery of well-organized data contained in federal and state tax forms, collected, assembled, and submitted by slave labor provided by taxpayers and employers. Furthermore, the number of such forms submitted to the IRS is a useful indicator of public consent, an important factor in strategic decision-making. Other data sources are given in the short list of inputs. Consent coefficients consist of numerical feedback indicating victory status. The psychological basis for this is when the government is able to collect tax and seize private property without just compensation, it is an indication that the public is ripe for surrender and is consenting to enslavement and legal encroachment. A good and easily quantified indicator of harvest time is the number of public citizens who pay income tax, despite an obvious lack of reciprocal or honest service from the government. The next step in the process of designing an economic amplifier is discovering the energy sources. The energy sources which support any primitive economic system are, of course, a supply of raw materials, and the consent of the people to labour and consequently assume a certain rank, position, level, or class in the social structure, that is, to provide labour at various levels in the pecking order. Each class, in guaranteeing its own level of income, controls the class immediately below it, hence preserving the class structure. This provides stability and security, but also government from the top. As time goes on and communication and education improve, the lower class elements of the social labour structure become knowledgeable and envious of the good things that the upper class members have. They also begin to attain a knowledge of energy systems and the ability to enforce their rise through the class structure. This threatens the sovereignty of the elite. If this rise of the lower classes can be postponed long enough, the elite can achieve energy dominance, and labour by consent no longer will hold a position of an essential energy source. Until such energy dominance is absolutely established, the consent of people to labour and let others handle their affairs must be taken into consideration. Since failure to do so could cause the people to interfere in the final transfer of energy sources to the control of the elite. It is essential to recognise that at this time, public consent is still an essential key to the release of energy in the process of economic amplification. Therefore, consent as an energy release mechanism will now be considered. The successful application of a strategy requires a careful study of inputs and outputs, the strategy connecting the inputs and the outputs, and the available energy sources to fuel the strategy. This study is called logistics. A logistical problem is studied at the elementary level first, and then levels of greater complexity are studied as a synthesis of elementary factors. This means that a given system is analysed, that is, broken down into its subsystems, and these in turn are analysed until by this process one arrives at the logistical atom, the individual. This is where the process of synthesis properly begins, at the time of birth of the individual. From the time a person leaves its mother's womb, its every effort is directed towards building, maintaining, and withdrawing into artificial wombs various sorts of substitute protective devices or shells. The objective of these artificial wombs is to provide a stable environment for both stable and unstable activity, to provide a shelter for the evolutionary processes of growth and maturity, that is, survival, to provide security for freedom, and to provide defensive protection for offensive activity. This is equally true of both the general public and the elite. However, there is a definite difference in the way each of these classes go about the solution of problems. The primary reason why the individual citizens of a country create a political structure is a subconscious wish or desire to perpetuate their own dependency relationship of childhood. Simply put, they want a human god to eliminate all risk from their life, pat them on the head, kiss their bruises, put a chicken on every dinner table, clothe their bodies, tuck them into bed at night, and tell them that everything will be all right when they wake up in the morning. This public demand is incredible, so the human god, the politician, meets incredibility with incredibility by promising the world and delivering nothing. So who is the bigger liar, the public or the godfather? This public behaviour is surrender, born of fear, laziness and expediency. It is the basis of the welfare state as a strategic weapon, useful against a disgusting public. Most people want to be able to subdue and or kill other human beings which disturb their daily lives, but they do not want to have to cope with the moral and religious issues which such an overt act on their part might raise. Therefore, they assign the dirty work to others, including their own children, so as to keep the blood off their hands. They rave about the humane treatment of animals, and then sit down to a delicious hamburger from a whitewashed slaughterhouse down the street and out of sight. But even more hypocritical, they pay taxes to finance a professional association of hitmen, collectively called politicians, and then complain about corruption in government. Again, most people want to be free to do things such as explore and so on, but they are afraid to fail. The fear of failure is manifested in irresponsibility, and especially in delegating those personal responsibilities to others where success is uncertain or carries possible or created liabilities in law which the person is not prepared to accept. They want authority, but they will not accept responsibility or liability. So they hire politicians to face reality for them. The people hire the politicians so that the people can obtain security without managing it, obtain action without thinking about it, inflict theft, injury, and death upon others without having to contemplate either life or death, avoid responsibility for their own intentions, obtain the benefits of reality and science without exerting themselves in the discipline of facing or learning either of these things. They give the politicians the power to create and manage a war machine, to provide for the survival of the nation or womb, to prevent encroachment of anything upon the nation or womb, to destroy the enemy who threatens the nation or womb, to destroy those citizens of their own country who do not conform for the sake of stability of the nation or womb. Politicians hold many quasi-military jobs, the lowest being the police, which are soldiers, the attorneys, next, who are the licensed spies and saboteurs, and the judges, who shout orders and run the closed union military shop for whatever the market will bear. The generals are industrialists. The presidential level of commander-in-chief is shared by the international bankers. The people know they have created this farce and financed it with their own taxes and consent, but they would rather knuckle under than be the hypocrite. Thus, a nation becomes divided into two very distinct parts, a docile sub-nation and a political sub-nation. The political sub-nation remains attached to the docile sub-nation, tolerates it, and leeches its substance until it grows strong enough to detach itself and then devour its parent.
My dad said to me as I left school, you need a job to pay your way. 'Cause things cost money and you're gonna need things. That's just the way things are today. So I left home and went to work at just 16. Started feeding the machine. Me and my brother moved into a flat. I paid my share of bills and rent. I got paid on a so-called Thursday. By Sunday night it was gone. That's how the weekends are all spent. And when the calendar's got you slaving for the 5 days in between, you're just feeding the machine. I got married, we had a couple of kids. I love them dearly to this day. But to put food on our table, put clothes on our backs, needed lots more pay. I got me a work promotion, but the tax man stripped me clean. I'm mostly feeding his machine. To buy our own place, I had to get a big loan. That's called a mortgage, I hear you cry. And that means debt pledge, and that's because it feels like you're paying till you die. And most of its interest that goes to the banks to team. They love us feeding their machine. And I worked harder, I got me a raise. I kept aiming for the top. He went up, so did my debts, and the interest never stops. I met me a bankster, he said, son, you may be keen, but you're just feeding my machine. Began to realize what was going on, and how those banksters call the shots. The system, all based on debt, lending money they ain't got. So it don't matter if you work hard, if you're generous or mean. From what I've seen, you're just feeding the machine. I did miss some learning about how it all works and how they trick you right from birth. Your name is money to them when you're playing the surf, but your sweat and your talent's what you really worth. But if you're reaping what you're sowing at the ignorance latrine, shit, you're just feeding the machine. And if you don't know where you're going and you're not sure where you've been, you're probably feeding the machine. But when your wisdom is showing you what a fool you've been, you'll stop feeding the machine. Let's stop feeding the machine. We're all feeding the machine. So let's stop feeding the machine.
That was Feeding the Machine from Litmus, one of his latest offerings, and extremely applicable, I think, to the subject matter in hand So that was the final bit of Synchro's readings for tonight. We have ignored a couple of sections that we were hoping to deal with about the construction of economic amplifiers and how that relates to advertising, and also a very intriguing piece at the end of the document, which is worth a read in itself, about the draft, otherwise known as conscription, and how the family is manipulated into making even the sending of one's own children to war, possible. The last section there was entitled primarily Diversion, the Primary Strategy, but it also contained little sections called Consent, the Primary Victory, and the Political Structure of a Nation, Dependency. And I think pretty much it spoke for itself, that did. I've been highlighting bits of this document as I've gone through, and though that last section, most of what was being said has been highlighted as of particular interest. My interest at this stage in the show is to point out that implicit within it are a whole load of solutions. So we heard once again that the simplest method of securing a silent weapon and gaining control of the public is to keep the public undisciplined and ignorant of the basic system principles on the one hand, while keeping them confused, disorganized, and distracted with matters of no real importance on the other hand. So once again, it's the secrecy of these weapons that makes them most effective, and we know from the work we're doing on People's Internet Radio that secrecy is being maintained in plain sight, really. All information about the basic constituents of this system are now available to people who go looking in the right places on the internet, listening to the right interviews, watching the right YouTube stuff, and all of that. There is plenty of information out there. Admittedly, it's quite difficult to weed the one from the other, but as one gets to comprehend certain elements of the system, it gets easier then to identify and comprehend other elements. The first step is to begin this business of study and comprehension and listening and paying attention to people who've actually got experience and to people who have it in their hearts to enable humanity, the people, to become once again free of the kind of slaughter and slavery and fraud which is completely endemic, epidemic, which is indeed the basis of the whole system. There is very little going on in the world that's being presented by the media and the TV and the newspapers which is not fraudulent in one sense or another. But as a basic rule, if you look at what's actually coming at you from the mainstream and assume that exactly the opposite is true, you will not go in very far wrong. And perhaps that's as good a guide as any to begin the study, is to realise that what you're looking for fundamentally is in some sense the opposite of what it is you've been told. As for being confused, disorganised and distracted, part of my process in all of this has been to realise that some of the thoughts that are in my head are not my own. So actually looking at what we think, giving ourselves a bit of peace and quiet, time to examine what it is that rises from within, looking at what we're thinking and trying to, if you like, step outside it and take a moral or an ethical stance and see whether what we feel in our hearts is actually reflected in what's going on in our minds. To a great extent, a lot of the information is already in there instinctually, and this sort of process is, I think, as well as logic and reason, is another good way of trying to discern the real from the unreal, the important from the unimportant. Which touches on this idea that one of the main methods by which this process is being successfully enacted is by disengaging people's minds. And all of us on PIR and in many other places, I'm sure, are aware that for a large portion of our life, we were engaged with feeding the machine, that our minds were disengaged, that we were effectively rats in a laboratory who were pressing a bar in order to get a bit of food or whatever resource it is that we're after. Does remind me though of a cartoon I once saw with a rat and a bar in a cage looking at a guy in a white coat outside the cage, and the caption underneath said, "Hey look, I've got this guy conditioned to give me a food pellet every time I press this bar, So this thing can be turned completely on its head, and right at the beginning we heard that these systems are just as valid for providing a public utopia as they are for providing a private one, and that again is one of the main reasons why it's important for the people who wrote this document that it remains a secret. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why I thought it might be worth doing a show about it, because the more this can be spread about, knowledge of what is going on is the most important thing as a stimulus to starting to think about it and then starting to act upon the new information that we're gaining. Engaging people's emotions is another important aspect. So much of what we see occurring in response to this information as it's introduced into the wider population is an emotional response. It's not an intellectual response. We can see that people are not thinking about what they're saying. They're not thinking about what they're doing. Their emotions have been entirely engaged to the point where what we get is an emotional response followed by the slide response, which means you're a conspiracy theorist. I don't need to listen to anything you say. Even if you have been looking at this stuff for 10, 20, 30 years, and I haven't looked at it at all, that is an emotional response. So again, examining our responses to see whether it is, whether it's emotion that's responding, or whether we are actually looking at it from some kind of moral or ethical or logical or rational base, and trying to distinguish between these two things. This system is trying to engage our emotions. We need once again to engage our minds, to engage our brains, to engage fields of study which enable us to step back a little bit. And of course the emotional response also involves a lot of anger, a lot of fear, a lot of frustration. And we know that one of the most important things we can do is to remain peaceful. And in order to remain convincingly peaceful, it is important to be able to disengage to a certain extent from our emotional responses. Another important part of how all of this is working is by giving people what they desire and depriving them of what they really need. So, as was emphasized again much earlier in the show, the difference between wants and needs are really, really important here. By chasing stuff that we want, or have been taught to want, or to been taught to think that we want, or whatever, we are necessitating for ourselves the need to work harder and harder and harder to get more and more and more things. And in that process, some 80% of the input is being subtracted and then poured into the machine, which is being used to make us feel and act in the way we are. We can genuinely identify our needs as opposed to our wants, life becomes a lot easier. And I am speaking from experience there. Over the last 3 or 4 years since we wandered off from the Stone Address, resource has been extremely limited and life on the edge has been uncertain. But with a limited resource, it is much easier to identify actual needs. What is it that we actually need in this moment? It also makes life a bit more relaxing in that when there is no resource at all, one just has to make do with whatever it is one's got. And of course, the resources that others willingly lend to us or give to us as a result of us wandering around trying to be helpful, trying to be useful, trying to be productive, trying to be peaceful, trying to be happy. All of these things make a difference to the way it works. And it has made a lot of difference in terms of Synchro and I being able to identify what it is that we need in the moment. There is very little confusion and a lot more clarity. Might seem a bit severe, but actually it is balanced by the fact that as well as there being limited resources, there seem to be expanded opportunities. More things turn up that it is possible to take advantage of. So it's not completely one-way thing. It's not a matter of total sacrifice. It is an output-input equation, just like really the whole of this evening's show has been about. Another important aspect of this is that history and law have been rewritten. Then the resulting deviant creation is what the public is being subjected to. Now, if history and law have been rewritten in order to achieve all of this, then another great thing to be doing, and I know there's many people on PIR who are doing this in some depth and then bringing the information to the forums and to the radio station and stuff for us to listen to. If history and law have been rewritten, it is our bounden duty to find out what the law actually is and what has actually happened in history as far as that is possible for us. Also, I'll point out once more that a lot of things that are put across in this document as being somehow associated with human nature are actually the product of the deviant creation to which we have been exposed. And as Bruce Lipman has put forward in his book, The Biology of Belief, he showed that when a set of cells are put into a petri dish and subjected to a violent or inimical environment, then they do not thrive. But if you take those very same cells out of the petri dish and put them in one that's got a helpful environment, one that is supportive and full of the nutrients that are needed, the cells very quickly become healthy again. This is not an undoable situation. Deviant creation, whoever it is that's running it, and for whatever reason it's being run, has resulted in the world that we see and the responses of the people within it. And it is possible to undo all of that. And it's possible to undo that just with a thought, really. It is not a resource-hungry process. What one needs most of all is time, and it's up to us what we choose to do with our time, just as it's up to us to choose what we do with our efforts, with our skills, and with income in whatever form it might come. And as well as subjecting us to the deviant creation, there is the shifting of our thoughts from personal needs to highly fabricated outside priorities. And again, we can look at what it is we're thinking about, what it is we're doing, and decide whether for ourselves whether it is a need or whether it is a fabricated priority. It's simply a matter of switching off the autopilot and taking control once more of the pedals and the wheel and all the other instruments that are available to us when we awaken to what's going on. It is important to these people to keep the adult public attention diverted away from real social issues and captivated by matters of no real importance. And that was an item that we covered in some detail earlier on, but it deserves re-emphasis here, I think, that again, we need to look carefully at what it is we're thinking about, what it is we're concerned about, and identify what are issues not just for us, but for the people around us. How can we best act in such a way that other people are benefited, and at the very least, our actions are not causing disadvantage to others, but as I say, preferably, if our actions can be a benefit to us and be a benefit to one or more people around us, then we are genuinely down here at the pixel level changing the nature of the world. We cannot possibly at this juncture be doing anything more important than that. Causing no damage, causing no harm, causing no loss, using no mischief in our contracts are all important. But if we can actually reverse all of those and do the opposite, if we can be beneficial influences in as many ways as possible and also endeavour to enable other people to be beneficial influences, then we are really seriously doing all that we can to turn this thing around. Keep the young public ignorant of real mathematics, real economics, real law, and real history. So having informed ourselves and having started to do the work that is necessary to understand what's going on, it is also necessary, it's even perhaps even more necessary, to ensure that the youngsters who are around us have as much of this information at their fingertips as possible, because they are the ones really who are going to have to deal with however all of this turns out. So that's to do with education, really. It's to do with information, real history, real maths, real economics, real law, and try to endeavour that the entertainment that's being given is somewhere above the sixth grade level, because at the moment that's where the advertising is, it's where lots of the entertainment is, it's certainly where the newspapers are. I mean, on the odd occasion I get lured into picking up mostly local papers, but occasionally a national one, when it happens to be at my fingertips. I'm absolutely stunned by the poverty of the language that's being used, by the poverty of the ideas that are being put across, and by the sad, sad lack of any kind of, word escapes me at the moment. any kind of discernment or argument in what it is that's going on, it's clear to me that what is going on now is people are being told what to think. They are not being told about what is going on. So again, it's important to be able to look at the information that's in front of us and see whether it's actually the best thing one can be reading or watching at the moment, or might there be a better way of spending our time. And at work, keep the public busy, busy, busy. Well, I know that certainly works pretty well for me. And again, it's perhaps important to emphasise that finding ourselves time, at least at the beginning and the end of each day, to be quiet and to look within and to be ourselves, is vital. Being kept so busy is one of the things that is distracting us fundamentally from what our actual needs are, and distracting us from the ability to think about what it is that's going on around us and come up with some sort of reasonable conclusion regarding it. As for real economics, of course, we do need to understand how the creation of money works. We do need to comprehend the nature of banks, the nature of interest, and we need at least to be able to go to a dictionary and look what usury is. And as far as possible, as well as comprehending these things, it's a good idea to try to withdraw our support for these things and reduce complicity in these particular frauds. And then all the information that is going into this system is going via the enforced delivery of data, which is being collected, assembled and submitted by slave labour and provided and handed over by taxpayers and employers. There is now an enormous amount of information being handed over, which is what's the input for this entire system. Again, extremely difficult to get out from under all of it, but substantially a lot of that can be achieved. In fact, it was the provision of information that first started causing me serious alarm, and it was eventually to lead to me investigating all of this stuff, was the demand that I register for the electoral roll. And it was the census, finally, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. I just looked at this 40-page document and I thought, who on earth is asking for this information? Before this came through my door, I was quite happily doing what I've always done here, and it was not a problem to anybody. And then suddenly a wad of paper arrives through my door and it says, if you don't fill this in, we may take you to court. We may fine you £1,000. And they were after information. Information which is now being used to provide for even further additional taxes and disadvantage to people who are in no position to actually cope with such demands. And the public demand for safety, which is, they say, driven by fear, laziness and expediency. Fear is one of the main things. Basically, if we are broadly speaking comfortable, it's down to the old better the devil you know than the devil you don't. And fear of changing things, fear that things might become worse or more difficult or harder to handle, is one of the things that prevents people from making change. I think we are now in a position where many, many people must be aware that there is something deeply, deeply wrong with what is going on here. But it is fear and perhaps expediency that prevents the majority of people from responding to this inner intuition or this reaction to what it is that's happening by actually doing something about it. Fear and expediency. I don't think that laziness is necessarily a fair word to use, because of course the deviant creation doesn't give people a lot of time deliberately to think about these things or to do anything about them. But the first step is to recognise that something is going on. The second step is to endeavour to find out what it is. And the third step is to begin to do something about it, to begin to try to divorce our own behaviours from the behaviours that are causing such mayhem and insanity. They said that most people want to be able to subdue and or kill other human beings. I really don't think that that is necessarily the case. I really do think that people who are subjecting themselves regularly to television soap operas, to violent movies, horror movies, to the news. The news has become much, 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 much more horrific over the years that I have been around. there are things shown on the news now which really wouldn't have been shown before, largely because I suspect in the old days they really didn't want to spook the horses. Now, spooking the horses is the order of the day. They want us held in fear and terror. And all of these influences result in changes in our own chemical structures, in the hormones that are being produced, perhaps keeping us in a state of permanent low-level panic, keeping us permanently in a state of fight or flight, which results in this apparent desire to subdue and or kill other human beings. Most of the people I come across, and again, perhaps I'm particularly lucky, most of the people I come across actually want to be able to help people who are obstructive or getting in the way. It is certainly not the tendency of the folk I know to actually want to subdue them or kill them. It is normally their intent, as far as I can see, to increase peacefulness and to help out, to deal with whatever the problem is that's within this other individual, and to try and make things work better rather than simply remove the obstruction. And then there is hypocrisy, I guess, almost in closing. People rave about the humane treatment of animals and then sit down to a delicious hamburger from a whitewashed slaughterhouse down the street and out of sight. Well, the British public apparently has a great love for animals, particularly birds, and yet the great mass of the British public eats meat. And this in itself is an ambiguity, if you like, a bit of, perhaps it's doublethink, that makes it very difficult for us to be comfortable with ourselves. It's certainly something that bears examination. And whilst my not eating meat isn't a kind of, or eating flesh is not a moral decision, it's just something that arose in me, I was particularly struck by that phrase. But the biggest hypocrisy is paying taxes to finance a professional association of hitmen, collectively called politicians, and then complain about corruption in government. Corruption in government is plain for all to see. Anything that's said in the manifestos is generally not enacted once people are voted into power, and it is quite clear, it should not have to be stated, that these people are promising everything and delivering nothing, and yet the people are paying more and more and more for less and less. And to a great extent, the politicians have become human gods, or more effectively, more accurately perhaps, the government has become a god. We surrender as much stuff to the god of government as older societies would have been surrendering to the temple, and a lot of stuff went that way. I think something like 8 out of every 10 pennies that you earn get handed over to a system which has been implied and stated in this document is merely interested in benevolent slavery, a very interesting phrase, and genocide. People who are lying to us, people who do not fulfil their promises, do not deserve our respect, and they certainly do not deserve to be sitting in positions where, at least nominally, they have control over the welfare and the outcomes of other people's lives. And finally, when the government is able to collect tax and seize private property without just compensation, it is an indication that the public is ripe for surrender and is consenting to enslavement and legal encroachment. A good and easily quantified indicator of harvest time is the number of public citizens who pay income tax, despite an obvious lack of reciprocal or honest service from the government. Absolutely right. And that, of course, is the final thing that it'd be a really good idea to look into, is just exactly where does any obligation to pay tax arise? And what are the taxes being used for? Where does the money go? Is it being used for emptying your bins? Is it being used for building roads? Probably the most potentially, personally lucrative area of investigation, along with the money. Which brings us about to the end of the show, really. I'd like to thank all of you for being out there and listening to it. Thank Synchro as well for all of the reading she's done. I'd like to thank the people who made Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars available as well, because whether or not It is a verified document, whether or not it is genuinely a CIA training manual, and whether or not it genuinely arises from the minutes of the first Bilderberg meeting way back in 1954 and emerged as a matter of policy is, I think, not important. There is so much material in here which is genuinely a statement of how things are being run that it has to be worth considering. If nothing else, as I say, it draws a whole amount of different subjects and makes them clearly available in text which is not difficult to understand. So thanks to Synchro, thanks to Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, and the people who brought it to the fore. Thanks, as usual, to People's Internet Radio for continuing to let me to come on and do these sort of things. And thanks to Nick Nomick, who I think has probably been hosting this show for me whilst I am in another sort of theatre, wearing fancy frocks and pretending to be something else. I shall probably not be around next week and not be able to get a show together like this one because time is really short. I shall, however, be at Fire in the Mountain, so at some point in the not-too-distant future we'll be coming back with a whole load of new music and hopefully a few interviews from there. The week after next, I'm hoping to have Paul Giovanni, who is the head honcho at Critical Mass Radio, talking about the things he's been doing over the last few weeks and months. So thanks most of all to all of you being out there and listening, both on the live radio show and those of you who catch up with the podcast. If you think there's anything in it at all, then try to encourage other people to listen to it. It might open a few minds. And we'll play out with Ignorance, Arrogance and Greed from the old Show of Hands, followed by Smile from Heal the Last Stand. Thanks a lot, folks. See you soon.
All I wanted was a home and a roof over our head, somewhere we could call our own, feel safer in our beds. There was a storm of money raining down, it only touched the ground. With a loan I took I can't repay, and the crock of gold you found. At every truck you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. I never was a cautious man, I spend more than I'm paid. But those with something put aside are the ones that you betray. With your bonuses and expenses you shoveled down your throat. Now you bit the hand that fed you. Dear God, I hope you choke. At every truck you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. You're on your yacht, we're on our knees. Your ignorance and greed. The toxics bring you tapped and sold, poisoned every watering hole. Your probity you exchange for gold. It sets his price. No feather bed, no golden neck, no one pays him twice. So where's your thrift and your caution and your honest sound advice? You know you dealt yourself a winning hand and loaded every dice. At every trough you stop to feed, your ignorance and greed. I pray one day we'll
four. I wonder about you when I'm walking through the park. You're everywhere I go, and I wonder who you are. I smile at you sometimes, and you even notice me. And if I'm paying attention, I get a chance to see that being good to people is as simple as a smile. That hopeful little moment where you catch somebody's eye, and they can tell and you can see that somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride. So many people in this world that I forget to stop and say hello. It's no wonder we ever met. Next time when I see you, I won't miss the chance again. 'Cause I see no reason why we should not be friends. 'Cause being good to people is as simple as a smile. That hopeful little moment when you catch somebody's eye. You can see that somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride. I know you've got a name and a family somewhere. I wonder where you're going and if I'll know anyone who's there. If we're somehow connected on the outside as within, can we not forget our differences and let the love begin? Being good to people is as simple as a smile. That hopeful little moment when you catch somebody's eye. They can tell you can see somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride. Being good to people is as simple as a smile. I hope a little moment when you catch somebody's eye, they can tell and you can see that somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride.
Thank you.